This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with conservation specialists relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is Adam Weaver, the Vice President of the National Speleological Society, the largest organization that studies, explores, and conserves caves with 250 chapters around the world. He is also one of the founders of the Black Hills Cave and Nature Conservancy. Adam is a project caver, focusing on many of the large projects in the western United States. He's an expedition leader in both Jewel National Monument, Wood Caves National Park, with substantial work in Lekkegila and Fort Stanton Caves, among others. He's vice chairman of the Paja Sapa Grotto. He explores caves around the country and has discovered and mapped around 70 miles of new cave passages. Professionally, Adam works as a hydrologist and cartographer, and he holds an MS in Natural Resource Stewardship from Colorado State University. So, Adam, it's great to be talking with you. I've never talked to a caver before, but so you're the first. So thanks for showing up. So there are apparently many different types of cavers. Tell us what they are, will you?
So, you know, the caving world has a lot of people that are interested in caving. And as John mentioned, you know, I'm a project caver, and that means that I work on projects. You know, and there's a number of large mapping projects around the country where we're working on systems that are, you know, up to 400 miles long, mapping the cave and figuring out where the cave goes. And that's important because if you want to protect a cave, you have to know where it is. I mean, it seems pretty obvious, but when you start looking at places like Jewel Cave National Monument, which is 210 miles long, or Mammoth Cave, which is 400 miles long, or 420, I guess, in Kentucky, those cave systems, you know, can be very deep under the ground, and you still don't want to put contaminants on the surface above them or allow certain types of surface activity to happen. So that's one of the aims. And then another thing that we do as we're mapping is we're obviously discovering places that no one's been before. And that's what's exciting to me, but, you know, other people have different things that they like. But it's one of the things that we find some microbes that live nowhere else on the planet. We find cave formations that are very beautiful and pristine. So if you want to see some great cave formations, type in to Google speleothem, and you'll find some amazing pictures of things that can only form where there's no weather.
Well, let me ask you, how do you protect a cave that winds underneath someone's private property and they don't punch down through it?
Well, you know, there's two different kind of thought processes about that. Is that either, you know, so if you have a large cave system that goes into private land where the entrance is, you can either go talk to that person and convince them of the importance of the cave, or you cannot tell them out of fear that they might drill their own entrance to the cave. So it kind of depends on who the individual party is there, right?
Well,
so if they're 1,000 feet deep, well, they're probably not going to drill an entrance, they'll probably go talk to them.
Sure.
So if the cave is like 4 feet deep, maybe just, you know, hope for the best. So that's always a basis and part of why caving is such an interesting hobby when compared to climbing, because caving, there's a lot of some secrecy involved in, like, trying to do what's best for the cave system. Because when the formations get damaged, most of the time they cannot be undamaged. You know, so you can't, there's restoration that happens, but a lot of the time it's a mitigation measure, not a repair.
But caves don't have any legal protection in and of themselves, is that right?
Right. So the Federal Cave Resource Protection Act in 1988 was a watershed event, and actually it's going to meet the people who were lobbying Congress to get that put through Congress was the NSS, and the president back then was actually from the same place that I'm from. His name's John Shelton. Our group was, like, critical in making that happen, and what that does, though, it protects all caves on federal lands. And so if the cave is on federal lands, it's protected. It's a felony to damage that cave. But on private land, if the cave, in most states, it's different everywhere, but in most states, if the cave is under your property, you own that part of the cave. You know, so you can kind of do what you want with it. And then there's obviously, endangered species in caves, and that's a whole different set of laws. But for the cave itself, it's mineral, so own it if you have it. But anyway, project caving, like I said, that's one of the big ones, right? And that's like what I do. And there's, you know, maybe 10% of cavers around the country or less are project cavers. And we work on large projects like the one you mentioned, you know, that I've been working on for years. And there's also conservation cavers, which are go in caves, they do restoration work, and they try to make sure people are, there's infrastructure in the cave that will prevent people that are going in the cave from damaging it. And a lot of show caves have conservation experts, and those, and a lot of big systems have people doing conservation work to mitigate, like I said, past accidental damage to the cave, which, you know, back in the early 1800s when caving really kind of like became a show cave business in the East, there was lots of things that were done then, and no one ever thought about them being wrong, but obviously they damaged the cave. So we're still kind of cleaning up from 200 years ago sometime. So there's conservationists, and they're great people. There's researchers, as I mentioned before. Explorers are tied closely to them because when we find things that are very interesting, like, you know, I was on this cave trip where we found a pine marten, which is a type of weasel, that was 16,000 years old in the cave and still had muscle and hair on it. And, you know, so obviously we found that during exploration, but it quickly became a research objective because paleontologists are interested in things like that, you know. So the research is tied closely to, like, obviously knowing where the cave goes. And there's all kinds of very interesting microbiological research going on in caves worldwide, as well as climate studies and paleontology, as well as many other people, you know. So there's those folks. There are cave biologists, which, you know, the most well-known of those are bat biologists. So there's a huge number of people who go in the cave specifically to deal with the animals and see what's going on there and make sure that because caves, because they're a closed system, can be an indicator of the larger system's health. So if you go in a cave and everything has died in it, then you should really start looking around and see what has caused this and what's going on, because the cave is a very delicate ecosystem, kind of like the canary in a coal mine a little bit. So there's a whole group of biologists as well. And then the largest group by far, are recreationists. So not so much in the West where you and I live, John, but in the East, you know, there are in what's called TAG, which stands for Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia, which is a caving region there. And there are literally thousands of caves there. And so the opportunity for recreation, just going in caves for the kind of the sport and the joy of just looking around, hopefully in a careful way, that's what they do there. You know, so they're recreating like normal sport climbers would do.
I think you told me that cavers don't like the Appalachian spelunker. Why is that?
Yeah, so the term spelunker has kind of some history associated with it, and you know, so back in the old days, all people going caving were spelunkers, and then eventually, as caving and groups like the National Speleological Society and the Cave Research Foundation, the large caving groups in the world, took off, and the local chapter started to form, beginning in the 1940s. Caving became more of a science kind of, and a thing that there was a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And as we learn more about cave conservation, as I mentioned, and mapping and all these things as an organization and as a sport, we became a lot more professional minded than your average person who goes out with a flashlight and finds a hole in the ground and wants to know what's in there, which is how we all kind of start, is out of curiosity, right?
But all right.
So there's people who are kind of unprepared and don't know what they're doing often lead to most of the accidents that happen in caves in the world and most of the damage that happens to caves. And those people are now, by the organized cavers, called spelunkers, and we're just cavers. So spelunking is most appropriately used for people who are kind of have no organization, no plan for what they're doing in the cave, don't really know or have training to do so. And so cavers are more of a trained, organized group that goes in a cave with a map, you know. a great example is the Thai cave rescue, which everyone knows. That was a spelunking trip. They didn't have a plan. They didn't think about weather infecting the cave. But that's like a classic spelunking accident there, which a more trained professional type of person would have been like, oh, this cave floods. We know that. We should, you know, plan appropriately.
So how many cavers are there in the U.S.? What's the estimated number?
Yeah, so you know, the only numbers that I have really are our numbers. The National Speleological Society, we're the biggest, and we have around 8,000 regular members in the NSS. And then the chapters, which are worldwide, there's about 25,000 grotto members, which most chapters are called grottos.
Uh-huh.
So there's about 25,000 grotto members.
Oh,
and there's out there. So almost every NSS member is in a grotto, but not all of them. So you're talking somewhere around 25,000-ish people in the country that are cave enthusiasts. I mean, and a lot of them, just like with anything, people get older and they just can't do it anymore, but they're still interested. So some of those people aren't active anymore.
So are there some publications that are produced for cavers?
Yeah, so the NSS News is the national caving magazine.
Uh-huh.
And it's produced monthly by the NSS, and it's a print edition. And so when you become a member, if you become like a full member, you get the NSS News mail to you every month. And so that kind of is like the caving news for the country. There's also a number of publications. If you go to like caves.org, like caves.org, there's a bookstore, and like it's all different kinds of books about caves. You can get the Teen Center for the Journal of Cave and Karst Studies, which is a scientific publication all about cave science that is also produced by us. Those are kind of like the main ones in the United States. But like I said, we have books on many different regions of caves and types of skills. Like there's a book called One Rope, which is currently being redone, which is about caving on rope, like vertical caving, rappelling and descending. Ascending, sorry. And then there's One Stations, which tells you how to map caves. There's a number of different things like that. You know, there's even books on cave photography. So there's been a lot of effort over the years put into, I guess, kind of developing the science of speleology from a hobby.
So how long have you been caving?
Yeah, so I started caving in 2010, which seems like, to me, not very long ago, but when you think it's almost 12 years ago, it's a long time. So yeah, I've been caving for a little over a decade, and like I said when I talked to you the first time, John, I've been caving, lucky enough to go all over the country in all different kinds of caves. And each region is kind of neat because the cavers have different idiosyncrasies and different things they like or don't like. And there's a few folks like me who kind of bounce around. Like, I have a home base here with two giant cave systems, but I like to go other places and see kind of what they're doing there as well. So
have you kept count of how many caves you've been in?
You know, I have not. It's one of the things that I wish that I had kept up. When I first started caving, I used to write down every cave trip in a book. And after, I don't know, less than a year, I kind of gave up on that because it would seem to be kind of a silly task. So now I kind of just loosely keep my mileage by each year I write down like kind of how many miles we met.
Uh-huh.
You know, we went about a month ago, I went to Tennessee, and me and two of my friends, we mapped 4 miles of cave in 6 days,
uh-huh,
which is a pretty large amount for cave mapping. So that's what we do. You know, I'm sure everybody else has a different metric that they look at things by.
So what's the longest amount of time you have spent underground in a cave?
So in a cave called Lechuguilla, which is in New Mexico, I've done 4 trips in there. Each one was 8 days long. And so they're all equally the longest. So, and I would tell you, on day 6, I'm usually kind of like, yeah, I could be on the surface right now. That'd be okay.
Uh-huh. What kind of equipment do you need when you're spending a long time in a cave?
Right. So really, and it doesn't change too much between the length a little bit, but so anytime you go into a cave, you have to kind of think that everything that you have with you is all that you're going to have, and everything that you take with you, you have to bring back out.
Right.
So we pack up very similarly to kind of an ultra-light backpacking setup. You know, when I go to Fort Stanton, for instance, which is another cave in New Mexico, I have a NeoAir Thermarest, a really ultralight sleeping bag, and then you don't have to have a tent because there's no weather, right?
Right.
So you don't have to worry about getting rain on.
Right.
And so you kind of have usually a tarp to put down to put your stuff on top of.
Uh-huh.
And the goal for that is obviously for abrasion resistance against your Thermarest, because the NeoAir is very thin, but also to make sure that, like, when you're sleeping and like rolling around and stuff, you're not leaving a whole bunch of hair or something in the cave. So when you get up, you kind of like fold your tarp up and take that stuff with you, because in a cave, and it's kind of hard to explain a little bit, but the system is so closed to nutrition that if you leave something in the cave, it almost immediately molds. So if you dropped a Skittle in a cave and came back a month later, you'd have like a cantaloupe-sized ball of mold right there, because those microbes are so used to having eaten nothing, basically a rock,
right,
that when you put something like that in there, they take off. So we're trying to be pretty conscious of that when we can. But then we use, just like ultralight back, we use Mountain House meals, freeze dried food, and stuff like that to eat. So, and hopefully there's a water source, which is, if not, you have to carry quite a bit of water.
Right, right. So, big question: how do you avoid getting lost in a cave?
Okay, well, yeah. So this is pretty dependent on what cave you're in. First of all, obviously, like I said before, you want to be a caver, not a spelunker. You know, so you want to have a plan.
Uh-huh.
And the plan really involves having the map. And so, you know, when we go to big systems, a lot of us that go there a lot, like, you know, if I go to Jewel Cave, which I'm a trip leader in, I will have the map of the section we're going to, and I'll know the route to get there. So I have a map for the whole part of the cave I don't know already. So either you kind of have a guide involved, you have a map for the parts that you're less sure about, and like I said, when we get to the frontier of the cave, the edge where no one's ever seen it before, you know, we stop there and we start making the map. We're creating the map with lasers, which are currently called a Disto X2. And so we're like mapping the cave extremely accurately moving forward. You know, so then if you ever did get lost, which doesn't happen because of the intricacy of making the map, you can just look back at your notes and say like, oh, you know, we should have went back there. And what also happens, and this is done pretty meticulously and with the least amount of impact as possible, is we're leaving a marker at each survey station, just like on the surface. So we're leaving these little markers that are labeled with the survey designation. So then if you have the map and you find one of the survey numbers,
right,
you say, oh, I'm at XO12, and you look at the map and you say, oh, it's right here, and then kind of orient yourself from there.
What's a marker? What describe a marker.
Well, yeah, and every cave is a little bit different. You know, here in South Dakota, we often make a small bullseye about the size of a quarter, and that can be made with a Sharpie or a whiteout sometimes is used. And you'll just write on a rock and set it next to it. The number is like fairly small. And it's done that way so that if you wanted to go back and remove the rocks that have the Sharpie on them, you could, right? So, and then you put them in a place where people are going to be kicking them or going through. Other places, some people use mylars, which are like a shiny marker, which are like real little, or some people use flagging tape, and they write on the flagging tape and set the flagging tape down. But you look at systems like Jewel Cave or Wind Cave, which are over 150 miles long, both of them, and think about how many stations are in the cave, and there can be tens of thousands of stations. So you want to make them something that is not going to damage the cave and are not going to be leaving stuff in the cave, essentially.
Do you retrieve those markers as you come back out?
No, so those markers remain. And like I said, so when you come back and you have the map, those markers are used for orientation, right?
So you leave them there as permanent locators.
Right, exactly, yeah. So,
uh-huh.
And that's pretty important, like I said, for orienting yourself to the cave. And who knows, you know, the next generation may come back and say, no, we're going to take them out. We have the map. We don't need them, which is fine. You know, every generation of caving kind of finds what makes sense to them. Just like we, you know, back in the old days, people didn't really think about like walking off lowstone and stuff. And now we're like, no, that's absolutely never going to happen again. So every generation sees cave conservation in a different light. And I'm sure, especially as the next generation, you know, will obviously be mapping the cave with some sort of handheld LIDAR. And I'm sure when that is the way to do it, it'll change the way it's done. So it'll be interesting to see what's going on when I'm 80 years old. Like,
right.
Like these kids.
So what kind of wildlife do you encounter in the caves?
Right, yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned before, there's a wealth of very specialized extremophile bacteria that live in the caves. And so those are some of the most interesting parts of it, because they have evolved to essentially live by eating limestone or other rocks. So they're pretty neat little guys, and there's lots of research being done to see exactly what they're doing and what we can use them for. And so is that. And then one thing that's kind of important to remember, like I said, there's very little nutrition available in the cave. So most species that live in caves, which are referred to as troglodytic species, you know, they're near the entrance. And so the most famous are bats. You know, obviously, not every cave has bats, and bats live in many places that aren't caves, but caves are one of the natural places that people think of bats living. And there are many large hibernaxula in the western United States. And so sometimes there's lots of bats. And so the goal with bats, obviously, is always not to disturb them during their hibernation period, because waking them up is pretty detrimental to them.
And how deep do you find bats in caves?
You know, usually they're in the first couple of thousand feet, but I think bats, and I could obviously be wrong with this, have been found as far as a few miles into a cave. But I mean, normally, just like us, they would get lost in the cave, so
yeah.
It has to be a special place for them to go very far. But they're usually in that first entrance series, the first few thousand feet. And then, so with bats, you know, you also have a large number of insects that are using the bat's guano as a food source, so you have a lot of that going on. My least favorite of cave insects is probably the centipede. I am very anti-centipede in my life. I do not like centipedes. But, you know, and there's a thing in the east which we don't have in the west, which are called cave crickets. Those are a very predominant cave species that are almost every cave in the eastern United States due to the moisture. And then, you know, you also have a lot of neat things like salamanders. Many different kinds of salamanders live in caves. You can find some pretty big ones. One thing you have to be really careful about when going into a cave, especially in the forest, is that a lot of rattlesnakes like to live in the first 100 feet or so of a cave. And so, obviously, if you're in a crawlway and you encounter a rattlesnake in the crawlway, that's not very good. You need to be very careful of that kind of thing.
Right.
And the same can be said for porcupines, is that if you're exiting a cave and there's a porcupine trying to come in, porcupines don't really back up very well. So a friend of mine had a bad interaction with that. So, and porcupines are super cool animals, don't get me wrong, but I mean, it's just things to think about if you're going to a cave is those kinds of things. And then, you know, I mean, in the western United States, probably the most common thing you will find in a cave are pack rats. Pack rats are super cute, but they you have to be careful, obviously, with the midden. They can carry a lot of diseases. So the number of caves I get to, we have to wear a dust mask for the first, like, 400 feet, and then you're kind of past that area. So.
Any birds that use caves?
There are a number of birds that will use a cave entrance to roost. And so you don't find that overly often in caves, just because the entrance for a bird to be comfortable with having their nest there, it has to be large enough that things can't reach them from the bottom. You know, so that is a thing. You know, I go caving in Hawaii sometimes, which are actually lava tubes. And there's actually a species of bird that's extinct that you can find their remains in cave, which is pretty neat. But normally birds are not too much of a cave thing, even though obviously giant caves have, you know, larger amounts of them because they're living on the ceiling of the cave.
So what's the most spectacular cave that you've explored?
Oh.
You rank them? Can you rank them?
Yeah, well, so it really just depends. You know, so every cave is very different. And, you know, Lechi Gia, which, you know, people go and they look up Lechi Gia, National Geographic has been there many times. And as far as cave formations go, it's maybe the most spectacular cave in the world. You know, it's full of, like, these giant, amazing formations. There is a place in there that I've been to where it has crystal trees that are 15 feet tall. You can walk through a forest of crystal white, pure white crystal trees. And so Lechi Gia is amazing for formations. It has giant passageway. And it's a really neat place. Then there's other places like Fort Stanton, which I mentioned before. And Fort Stanton has the longest single cave formation in the world, which is currently, I think, about 14 miles long as it's mapped, but it keeps going. And so that cave is amazing because you go in there and you get onto what's called Snowy River, and it's a white calcite, pure white calcite floor. And you can kind of start going down to the cave at a very rapid rate. And travel for hours and hours in just one straight line in one direction, and it feels like it's going to go forever, you know. And so when you get to the end, you know, you map quite a distance, and then you just stop, and it just keeps going just as it's been for 14 miles. So it's a pretty amazing place as well. And then Jewel Cave, which is, you know, kind of my hometown cave here in the Black Hills.
Right, right.
I find it to be kind of the most spectacular because of its, you know, the kind of the term that we always use with Jewel Cave is that there's no end in sight. And it's because the cave is it's less mazy than some other caves like Wind Cave, but it's, you go to the end of the cave system, right? And it isn't like Fort Stanton where it's just one passageway that's just going forever. It's kind of a labyrinth of caves. So on our last trip in there, we left four passageways that were going in kind of different directions, different angles from each other. They were all like 80 feet tall. And, you know, you're mapping, you're exploring, you have to just be like, okay, we're going to go down this one as far as it goes. And it might go, you know, for the rest of your life. You know, you can just pick one and say, we're going to do this one today, and we'll go till it ends. And it might never end, you know, because, you know, I'm the third generation of people mapping the cave. And in the original mappers mapped for years and years and years until they got too old and then turned it over to the next group. And now we're three generations in, and the cave just continuing kind of every direction forever.
Adam,
so it's amazing.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, are there any archaeological finds that you've come across in caves that you've explored?
There's different kinds. You know, a lot of the really big systems, obviously, just like bats, you know, ancient peoples didn't go far into them. But, you know, like, so I've been to a cave, which I'm not going to say the name of, fairly recently, that where there was Native American archaeological remains there from 3,500 years ago.
Uh-huh.
So those are obviously studied pretty heavily by some archaeologists now after they were found. So those were discovered by explorers, and then another archaeological site that we're trying to learn about who these people were and why were they in the cave and what were they doing. And then some like newer stuff, which is kind of neat, a cave here in the Black Hills called Bethlehem Cave. We're working on remapping it for a more accurate map. And we found a bunch of newspapers from like the 1890s that are still in the cave. Same thing with Wind Cave. Wind Cave National Park has a ton of newspaper in it. Because back in the olden days, they would let people wrap formations in the newspaper and take them home when they did the cave tour, which obviously we don't do anymore.
Right.
They thought that was okay. You know, things have changed. And so there's lots of like, because caves, there's no weather. They hold things forever, you know, so you can go there and find things, even paper that's hundreds of years old.
So we're about out of time. If someone's interested in getting involved in caving, how do they find out how to get involved?
Okay, yeah. So I mean, probably the easiest way is to go to caves.org, like I said before, CAVS.org. And on the homepage there'll be a thing that says find a grotto. And so the grottos are the cave clubs, and the best way to get started is to find your local cave club, and they're gonna know about the caves where you live. And they'll meet you and kind of size you up and figure out what is the appropriate thing for you to start with. Everyone is different, you know. So
That's great help. Okay, well, we've done it. Thank you very much. It's been very interesting, and good luck. Don't get lost in any of those caves. Our guest today has been Adam Weaver, Vice President of the National Speleological Society and an active caver in South Dakota and all over the U.S. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallon Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, Google Wilderness and Wildlife, or go online to jswilderness5.net and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.